In the years since our book was published, there has probably been more research in brain and mind phenomena than ever in the history of the world. Yet going over this material, at least in summary, it is noticeable that very few really new conclusions have been reached. We know much more about the functional manifestation of mental energy than ever before. But as to the essential nature of that energy, as to the essential meaning of the classical terms used in religion and philosophy to explain or to describe the basic facts of existence, in these areas, very little has actually been accomplished. I note one rather interesting trend that perhaps is worth mentioning. The tendency today to avoid the term consciousness in the preparation of a learned thesis. The tendency is to be afraid of the implication of that word. Also, that under this one term, we have grouped so large an area of specialized meanings that the term is no longer comprehensive or comprehensible in an effort to make a factual statement. This brings us, therefore, to one of the important areas of our discussion this evening. We are dealing with two chapters of our book relating to the brain, and also relating to the symbolism that has survived for us concerning the power of the release of the consciousness at death. So let us try to be somewhat orderly and pay tribute where we can to modern form and modern usage, and begin with a study of consciousness. Now, it is obvious that this is a highly controversial field, and we have no intentions of being dogmatic. Yet in all controversy, the various aspects of a problem must be presented. We use the term consciousness in philosophy, particularly, to represent a very abstract principle, a principle of universal awareness, a universal state of which things have some nature of and in themselves, from which they are able to gradually evolve faculties and powers involving discrimination, thought, reflection, and memory. That these must exist as seed principles cannot be denied, because we are able to observe the consequences of the growth of these seeds in the development of organized forms of life. We are aware, for example, of the existence of a vast archetypal pattern in the universe. This archetypal pattern indicates a plan or a purpose. And to plan and to purpose, these are aspects of the works of consciousness. Plans do not arise in the absence of cognitional principles. That which has no existence of itself cannot plan the existence of it of any other thing. Thus we come to a classical point as quickly as we can, namely that there exists everywhere in space, substance, and essence, a universal animating power. that this animating power possesses among its attributes awareness and self-awareness. Awareness may be like the warm glow of a sunrise. Self-awareness, the light of the risen sun itself. We have every reason to suspect, and even science does not dare to erase this probability. We have every reason to suspect that the root of what we call consciousness is present in every molecular unit, in every cell, in every electron, and in modern terms, in every atom. That this atom, this unit, contains the potential power of awareness, and that what we commonly term the growth or unfoldment of life is made possible primarily through the continuous release of awareness in things. Thus, as surely as man grows by the unfoldments of faculties and powers, so all these faculties and powers are dependent upon the presence of a suitable energy to sustain them, to vitalize them, to ensoul them with its own interior awareness power. We may liken our problem somewhat to the mystery of a telephone. The establishment of the phones and the wiring will not result in the possibility of communication unless an energy is also given to those wires by which they become capable of transmission. Thus, that energy must be present in practically all phenomenal activity of the universe. This energy, in various levels and in various ways, supports function, makes function possible and real, and supplies to every structural unit in nature an enlivening power. What is this power? Perhaps it is more convenient for us to attempt to note its existence first in this way. This existence can be bestowed, and it apparently can be removed or withdrawn. The state of life seems to reveal to us the presence of this inner awareness energy. The loss of life, the condition of death, seems to reveal to us the departure or the cessation of this energy. Science would be the last to assume that energy is destructible. Therefore, what we would term death cannot be regarded as a destruction of energy. And by extension, we have a strong case in the favor of the fact that death cannot be regarded as an extinction of consciousness. Death, however, is a phenomenon involved in the relationship between consciousness and a medium of manifestation. Obviously, consciousness can fail to animate a form. And when energy involving consciousness totally departs from a form, that form disintegrates. And all of its activities upon the level of our consciousness will cease. Thus we have an energy or a form of life which by its presence activates all of the composite nature of a being. And by its absence or removal causes the end of such activation, leaving that body or form inanimate, or reducing it to forms of activity far lower than that with which we are concerned in the study of consciousness. We must, however, be immediately aware that our term consciousness, involving the principle of energy, must be universal, everywhere present, and therefore can be understood as being present in forms of life lower than those of the human being as we know him. This brings us then to the next important problem. In man, we have what we call the brain. The question as to the relationship between the brain and consciousness has been a moot one for thousands of years. Man experiences the processes of mentation as occurring in his head. He senses or feels this. He senses it perhaps for real or perhaps for less valid reasons. Perhaps he senses it because so many of his sensory perceptions are grouped here. Perhaps he senses it because of the proximity of sight, so that things seen appear to enter our natures through the head. Perhaps through the power of sound, it would appear that if nature wishes to establish the sensory instruments in as close proximity as possible to the centers with which they are associated, that the head must be in some distinct and definite manner closely associated with sensory processes and the various functional and sensory activities with which man is concerned. Now, the problem as to where this process starts and how it starts seems to bring to us one immediate answer, namely, that the brain is like any other instrument or machine composed of physical elements, that the brain is not a thinker, that the brain is not a mentally alive structure. The brain is a physical structure which can only be alive because life is communicated to it, or that in some way its own structure captures or releases life. We know that this is true to a large degree through experiments in mental phenomena. We have become increasingly convinced that we must regard the brain as an area peculiarly responsible to the processes, responsive to the processes of thought and mentation. That this area of structure must supply us with the most subtle parts of body, must supply us with very subtle instruments, such as those that we are now discovering in our researches in atomics and electronics, but that the brain itself is only able to think because of the presence of an energy. That it is the loss of this energy which prevents thought. It is the failure of this energy which makes thought impossible. And it is the ending of this energy which, among other forms of consequence, at death ceases as a medium for the expression of active mental processes. So we have brain, and we have energy. And now we have to find out, if we can, the relationship between energy and brain. This causes us to come into consideration of a classical term, which perhaps we need at this time. And that is mind. What is the relationship between brain and mind? What is the relationship between mind and energy? We must assume that mind is a structure, whether we can see it or not, which is made active by the presence of mental energy. Just as the brain achieves its activity through the presence of physical or nervous energy. Therefore, the mind is not identical with the brain. Yet the mind, in our periods of living consciousness in this world, always manifests through the brain, or in some way is associated with brain process. So we may say that the mind is a kind of overbrain, or a brain invisible, functioning through a visible structure. The Greeks would say that the mind is a form and the brain is a body. A form being a compound of energy and matter. In a compound more subtle, more attenuated than that of a body. So we may be dealing with a principle. And that principle is the principle of mind. Now, how shall we understand this? Oriental philosophy, I think, gives us one of the clues to it. Mind is a form of the word, or an extension into our language of the word manas, which in turn is a synonym in Sanskrit for the name or term for man. Man, manas. Therefore, the mind is a human instrument. Peculiar and natural to that degree of evolutionary process which we call human. Mind is therefore a kind of body, invisible, but essentially rooted to the humanity of man. And this mind becomes, so to say, the overself, the archetypal being. And according to most systems of philosophy that believe in the survival of an intelligent entity after death, it is this mental entity which survives. And it is the belief in many philosophical systems that the mental entity is the superior entity, and at least relatively speaking, the true entity. And that therefore this entity, by union with body, causes mental activity to be released through brain. This mental activity, as the term implies, includes the activity principle itself. Therefore, a mind is also a vitalized area. It is a subtle structure sustained by energy, even as the brain is a grosser structure, also sustained by energy. Now, it is reasonable and not difficult to recognize that there must be, and always have been, degrees of relationships between various life forms in nature. We cannot assume the existence of space and then of man. Man must be bound to space by certain bonds and ties. Space moving in upon man must achieve union with man by means of a series of emanational forms or structures. Thus, between two very different forms of life, there must be intermediate forms, forms which partake of one or the other to some degree, but make of their own natures bridges across which energies can move. Pure energy, therefore, striking the brain of man, might keep this brain alive, that would not bestow upon this brain any mental processes. It is therefore essential that consciousness or life or energy moving into the brain structure of man must first pass through a mental conditioning, and that it is this mental structure which finally forms the tie between energy and brain. Therefore, mind is mentally conditioned energy. It is energy which has evolved into a mental integration. It is energy in its aspect of thought. And it is furthermore energy which, as thought, has created an instrument for its own expression, an invisible but real instrument, the instrument we know as mind. If this is then a reasonable assumption, we can then explain or understand how mind, overshadowing brain, can cause brain to become an instrument for the release of mental processes. Now, in this procedure of mental process, what is mind, essentially? Is mind the same as consciousness? No. Mind is very obviously and definitely conditioned. Mind is not pure consciousness, nor is it pure life in any form. Mind is already life reduced to a mental equation, functioning as a mental energy in an instrument suitable for such specialization of cosmic life power itself. Thus, mind is already a highly evolved, highly complex structure in which universal energy is manifesting itself as universal thought power. If we go on just a little further with this, we can then see how it might well be that the mental entity, or that part of the rational being which is mental, can have an existence apart from body, can be associated with it, can unfold and evolve through it, can depart from it, and in so doing, destroy the effectiveness of the brain, but in no way change or alter its own nature. Thus we come to a point which is gaining greater favor every day in scientific circles. Namely, that it is possible for a thought substance to exist apart from a material substance. That mind can have a nature and existence of itself, and that its relationship to man is, therefore, a relationship of compound, and that all such compounds can be and must necessarily be dissolved at some time or another. This, then, gives us a scientific approach to the problem of a mental survival which is not dependent upon the continuance of a physical brain. But is this surviving mental nature going to be identical with the brain mental nature with which we are familiar? In other words, can a person drop the brain and still be the same kind of thinker that he was when he had a brain? Of course, this always assumes that he did some thinking while he had the brain, which may be open to some dispute. Some hope that they will do better without the brain than they have done with it. Some view the brain as a prison for already potential cosmic consciousness, and they can hardly wait to leave it behind. Others, less optimistic, wonder if they are going to have any consciousness beyond the grave, And because of the brain-bound nature of their thinking while they are here, have they thought anything here that would be any use to them anywhere else? This is another important consideration. In this somewhat critical dilemma, I think we may then ask, what is the essential function of mind? Is mind actually the thinker? Is mind a self-thinking instrument? Or is mind, in turn, only a conditioning instrument? Let us assume something which science thinks is rather good these days. Namely, that the brain finds itself extended throughout the entire physical body as the nervous system. That the nervous system is merely an extension of the brain. That theoretically, therefore, wherever there is a nerve filament, some form of brain function can be present. And that because all these filaments, like the telephone wire, have become vitalized by an energy, all of these filaments can communicate, and that any message sent over them will finally be deposited in the brain. As a result of this, the brain has two distinct functions in coordination with the nervous system. One is to receive the continuous battery of impulses. Impulses which, coming along the nervous system, reach various areas of brain structure where they are specialized or where they are brought back into some relationship with the original impulse. Obviously, when we touch an object, that object does not go into the nerve and reach the brain. We are not aware of a table because the nerve takes the table in there. We are aware of it because a series of impulses, much like the grooves of a recording, create a vibratory process which can be reassembled in the brain to reconstruct the table or any other object under consideration. Thus, there is constantly flowing into the brain the almost continuous battery of impulses, of things picked up or recorded by all parts of the nervous system. And for that matter, these impulses can be picked up by a process of induction so that the object does not entirely have to even touch a nerve for the impression of that object to be recorded in the brain. This situation then is paralleled by the fact that through the nervous system, the brain is continually exercising executive control over function. By means of the brain, the hand obeys the thought. By means of the various centers in the brain, the body becomes a kind of instrument under the continuous control of a central coordinator. This causes us to then try to decide the nature of consciousness in a little different way. Not having any good definition at hand, we suddenly discover we need two, that one will not even do it, because we have two distinct processes under consideration. We have consciousness as vitalizer, which is probably its essential basic nature. Then we have consciousness as interpreter, or consciousness making things knowable or understandable. And these are entirely different processes. Therefore, we must assume that we are dealing with a kind of consciousness that is universal and which we experience only as the total fact of existence. then we are dealing with a conditioned consciousness, which we experience in the terms of knowing and self-knowing. The generalized type of consciousness makes us alive. The more specialized type permits us to go to school and learn. And these two are not the same. One is a very much specialized and limited aspect of the other. The universal consciousness has infinite functions, uncountable and unknowable propensities, whereas personal consciousness is extremely limited. And as far as its own abilities are concerned, reflects from universal consciousness little more than energization or the power of its own existence. The rest is comparatively a result of lesser function. The brain being, as it were, the gateway to the mind, becomes the intricate machinery by means of which sensation, recorded by the peripheral nervous system and the sensory structure, sensation is carried into the brain field, and here a series of processes begin which end in the individual experiencing certain reactions, certain inevitable processes. Thus, objective consciousness is the consciousness of the power to experience, the consciousness of the power to be aware of certain particular special happenings, all of these happenings within the field of awareness provided by the nervous system of the physical body. In speaking of consciousness, therefore, Buddha, rather pessimistically, describes what we call consciousness as nothing more nor less than the alchemical product of sensation. That the individual's mental life as we know it, his attitudes on all things, his feelings, his impressions, his convictions, his emotions, his thoughts, his reflexes, are all of them simply the byproducts of sensation entering the brain and finally coming into a state of coordination because of the existence of an invisible coordinator called mind. The mind is therefore the coordinator of sensation. The brain is the instrument for the recording of sensation. But the brain of itself cannot coordinate anything any more than one of these elaborate human or rather mechanical brains that we have devised lately can in any way rationalize or be reasonable. Their function is left entirely to such processes as can be mechanically achieved. These may in turn or in time produce patterns that are highly indicative of facts. But unless man comes in and interprets the machine to his own purposes, its statistics are of comparatively no value. Certainly, they are of no value to the machine itself. Therefore, in this process, man plays the coordinator, and the machine plays the brain. This is perhaps as close to it as we can come in a common, everyday analogy. Considering this process, then, we may say that what we call consciousness is a result of sensation entering in, being coordinated, and in the process of coordination, being transformed from a series of impulses to a kind of compound idea or attitude. This attitude, in turn, moving back out through the nervous system, becomes the guide of conduct. Thus, the individual, from his sensations, creates his attitudes. And by his attitudes, he directs his life. The attitudes with which he directs life, in their turn, bring him into contact with new and different patterns of sensation. These, in turn, are carried back into the brain, arranged by the coordinator, and released as modifications of conduct. All this process is summing itself up in a simple statement of an individual: that is the way I thought it was yesterday. Today I have changed my mind. The only reason why we change the mind is because through the sensation and through the coordinating power of the brain, some new circumstance has been brought to our awareness, a circumstance which requires a modification of our previous state of awareness. Buddha carries this a little further and uses the wheel of the doctrine, the Dharma Chakra, to represent this process. And all we have to do to see exactly what he meant is to assume that this wheel is one of the wheels in a squirrel cage. That actually, we continue to run and run and run, and the wheel turns and we stay where we are. This process, this cycle between the acceptance of sensation and the release of attitude, which in turn causing new sensational evidence, causes again modification of attitude. This process is the area in which the average individual's so-called alleged consciousness is locked. When he says, "This I believe," he is speaking only from this sequence of sensation producing in its turn modification of the previous evidences of itself. When the individual says, "This I am," his so-called I am-ness is merely the calculated conclusion of his mental coordinator concerning himself. It has nothing to do with that which is not to be sensed, examined, explored, or interpreted by this coordinator. Man looks into a mirror, sees his own likeness, and says, "Obviously, here I am." This is considered to be direct thinking. But the only reason he is able to say, "Here I am," is that a series of sensory testimonies have been carried to the brain. Cut these testimonies off so that the individual is aware neither of the mirror nor of himself. And he cannot arrive at this conclusion any more than a person born totally blind can ever arrive at true color consciousness. It is only because of the faculties we possess and their use, according to the laws governing these faculties themselves, that we are able to come to certain definite conclusions about our own existence, the existence of other things, the past from which we came, the present in which we now live, and the future which we hope for. These things all exist because of the continuous cyclic interplay of sensation and rationalization through mental alchemy. If this be more or less reasonable, and there is much evidence to sustain it, particularly in the field of abnormal psychology, man remains today what he has always been, a being who does not know himself, who has no way of actually becoming aware of his own true nature. Because it is obvious that this true nature cannot be fully comprehended on the basis of the sensory cycle. Man cannot experience the invisible part of himself. He does not know how. It will not be discernible to any sensory perception. And for lack of this ability to capture it within the net of the five senses, the individual cannot know about it. Therefore, what we term speculation on these subjects is merely the pressing of the familiar along back toward the unfamiliar. It is the imposing of the world of senses upon the unseen universe that cannot be comprehended. Therefore, we merely project our physical thinking into space and call it metaphysics. This is what it essentially amounts to. It is our own pattern that simply seeks for solution by the rarefaction of its own accepted processes. We see this in the study of all primitive culture, where God emerges as king, merely the extension of the tribal chieftain. Always deity is the hero or the chieftain or the patriarch we have known plus. And this plus is achieved in art by putting a halo around his head. It's the best we can do with it. But when we put the halo around his head, we tell everyone the explanation of the halo, and it becomes a word. And this word says, I am not human. I am superior to that which is human. Thus, we put wings on angels, not because we've ever seen any with real feathers, but because we wish it to be known that we are not dealing with literal human beings. And not knowing how to draw an angel in proper person, we draw the most attractive human being that we can, and then make it an angel by the adding of wings, much as the Mayas made a verb out of a noun by also adding a wing to signify energy. So we are pushing these sensory conclusions backward. And we are trying continuously to penetrate the unknown by the brute force and awkwardness of sensory intensity. But we are blocked for the reason that the mental coordinator cannot coordinate that which the senses do not bring in. The mental coordinator has no existence apart from the process of coordination itself. So we experience it because we use it. If it was not used, it would vanish from our awareness and we would not know that it exists. Thus we have now the brain, and we recognize the tremendous mystery of this structure. We realize that in many respects it is one of our most valuable possessions. It is an instrument created almost like a television or a radio, by means of which we can tune in the processes of mental energy by which man is able to solemnly and seriously declare that he is a thinking being. This thinking being the executive leadership of the mind over the testimonies of the sensory perceptions. Facts, therefore, as we think of them scientifically, are bound very closely to sensory perceptions. The scientist doubts that which the physical faculties cannot sustain. And as far as he can go, he uses them. Where he cannot use these, he uses the scientific processes of mathematics to substitute symbols for facts. and to call upon the highest available resources of the mental coordinator. If this thinking has some value in principle, and it seems to come the nearest to any solution that we know, we can then say, what is the pure nature of mind itself as separated from brain? If the individual is to step out of the brain, what happens to him? The first thing that must inevitably happen, of course, is that any form of sensation dependent upon the brain and the nervous system must be blocked or cut off. The individual is no longer, therefore, able to experience this mysterious cycle of the Dharma chakra. He is no longer able to defend his sensations with his mental coordinator or express his mental coordination through his sensory functions. Thus he becomes, so to say, separated from a sphere of activity in which the brain is the one and only link. Consequently, the phenomenal universe as he knows it must cease to exist. Aye, but there's one other factor. And that other factor is that among the mental coordinating factors that have been brought out by this process through evolution is a power of retention. Therefore, it is true likewise that the individual is continually building a mental image. Without this mental image, the value of sensation and reflex would be comparatively nil. The individual would have the perfect capacity to make the same mistake a million times and never even know that he did it. It is only by use of the retentive faculty that thoughts remind us of previous experiences, or previous experiences are retained to become, in a sense, censors over new testimony. This procedure then tells one other thing, that if the sensory area is blocked by the loss of the body, by brain disease, or by any other circumstance which renders the brain function impossible, then the mind still has a mental existence of its own, an existence in an area of things remembered, an internal existence. Now, as far as that is concerned, would such an internal existence be any different as far as the mental pattern is concerned than it would be if we still had the brain and the sensory function here? Actually, the world around us does not enter into us. The world around us simply becomes the basis of these experiences, which, carried along the lines of the sensory perceptions, become organized in the mind into images, ideas, and patterns. Consequently, the power of the mind to image is not destroyed by the loss of the body. The only thing that is lost is the power to receive continual physical stimulus, which might rapidly or dramatically change or modify the brain's imagery. Buddhists make a great point of this in connection with the after-death state and in the use of their great religious ritual of the bardo, the equivalent of the Egyptian ritual of the dead. The concept here being that the mind can retain the imagery of its own processes and will retain the estate which it has achieved by the interpretation of sensory phenomena, and that this will continue and will survive and will ultimately be capable of informing a new body. so that the individual's mental life can be transferred from one form to another. And being so transferred, it retains that degree of judgment or coordination which it has previously attained. And when the new brain is available, it simply continues to receive further stimuli and to coordinate these in terms of its own attainment until finally the brain theoretically can attain to the full possession of this mental process, so that in certain persons of apparently great wisdom, the brain seems to be superior to that of the average individual. Actually, however, the evolution of brain process is merely a shadow of the evolution of mental integration. It is the mind that ensouls the brain that is the growing structure. The brain only can achieve a continuing refinement of organic quality so that the mind may function more accurately through it and receive information more completely and rapidly from the sensory reflexes. This ends in what many Eastern philosophies have believed in the peculiar blind end of the mind gradually gaining an estate of itself, so that there is a kind of immortality conferred by mentation, and that the mind theoretically as an entity can go on growing, experiencing through a sequence of brains which it inhabits, until finally the mental being attains a very high degree of refinement, a very high degree of skill in estimating phenomena. But all the way through, even in its most reflective moods, the mind still retains its essential problem, that of dependency upon sensation for the stimulation of its resources. Now, how then can we identify or separate mind from mental brain phenomena? How are we to discover the nature of mind as it is? This was one of the reasons for the development of the theory of contemplative or meditative discipline. It was the belief of ancient peoples that the mental entity could best be experienced in its own nature by the gradual reduction of the influence or pressure of brain sensation stimulation. Thus, in quietude, in the gradual attainment of discrimination, in the reduction of the intensity of sensory existence, it became evident that less and less phenomena would be communicated to the mental entity. Theoretically, if the mental entity during life reaches a certain degree of relaxation in which it is no longer forced to interpret phenomena, the individual, the mystic, has come to the conclusion that it is possible then that he might be able to experience the laws of mind, whereas now he can experience only the laws of brain. If the mind has an existence apart from the body, then it has an existence of itself, which is not to be merely the shadowed reflection of physical circumstances. And the mind, having its own mental life, can produce a kind of mentation in which the laws of mind, the laws of the mental state of knowing, which are best expressed in the concept of reason or the concept of true judgment or the concept of abstract creative mentation, these processes come to the individual who is able to break the continual tyranny of sensation, which bombarding the mental equipment all the time forbids the mind to express its own nature, but permits it only to express the reflex of our own purposes. As this procedure goes along, the mystic holds very strongly to the conviction that the mind processes, as they relax and become unconditioned by environment pressure, begin to develop these capacities which we associate with the mystical experience or some higher divine state of being. Beyond the mind remains the unsolved mystery of consciousness itself. The brain is personal. The mind is individual. Consciousness is universal. And the bridge between mind as universal and consciousness is as yet extremely dim to us, although it seems that at certain times a flash of pure consciousness does become available. More likely, however, it is still conditioned, but being better than we have previously had seems as though it is pure divinity itself. Consciousness in Eastern philosophy is the exact opposite of consciousness as we know it objectively. Therefore, in terms of the experience sensation processes of brain and mind, true consciousness is conceived of only as a vacuum, only as that which is not mentation, that which is not brain or sensation reflex. If we want to study this matter further, we can gain a great deal of consolation, as I have noted in the book, from the study of various parallel systems of world religion and philosophy. The world has always recognized that in some way the brain had to do with the great processes of manifestation. The great triad in the body of man, corresponding to the three persons of the Godhead, was the heart, the brain, and the reproductive system. These represented the three great life centers, without which the function of the human being would be impossible. It was the opinion of the ancients that what we term now as energy or pure life has its polarization in the human heart, and that from this polarization, the energy is communicated to the brain by which it is activated. Therefore, that the source, the dynamo, the reservoir of energy in man is brought in and manifested through the heart center. That this in turn is then distributed throughout the body, and a specialized aspect of it becomes polarized in the brain, and the other or negative aspect becomes polarized in the reproduction of the species. This balance of energy would then cause us to assume that if we could go deeper than the brain in search of a center for consciousness, that we would turn and must turn to the heart. That the heart, therefore, lies behind the manifestation of energy which we know as brain mental energy. If, therefore, a superior nature possesses the brain with its mind, it possesses the heart with its consciousness. And the heart is to the consciousness what the brain is to the mind. This consciousness the ancients called spirit, and they therefore assumed that the spirit had its abode in the heart, the soul, which included the entire psychic nature, in the brain, and the energy or vitality in the great generative complex of nerves. In this way, a triad was established, and we can then continue, perhaps even with the thought from the Bible, as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he.